Thank you for tuning in to the Helium Radio Network. You are listening to a rebroadcast of a previously recorded show.
We don't have to pretend that the only good jobs are hard hat jobs, right? We can actually take seriously the way that our economy and our labor market has changed already and, you know, begin to invest in the kinds of work that it does seem like we really have sustainable demand for, and to try to improve that work rather than, you know, offloading this kind of tasks onto poor women and, you know, keeping them poor doing so.
That's Gabriel Winant, Assistant Professor of History at the University of Chicago. And this is Healthcare Confidential. I'm your host, Teresa Jacob Ellis, bringing innovators and experts together to discuss the American healthcare system. Healthcare and social assistance account for 14% of the labor force in the United States. And this is a sector that has grown exponentially, particularly among the lowest paid. In the 1980s, the so-called care economy was responsible for 56% of growth in the lowest wage jobs in America. In the 1990s, that became 63%, and by the 2000s, 74% of low-wage job growth was in the care sector. During the COVID-19 pandemic, these workers were described as essential workers, and yet they remain among the lowest paid. Our guest, Gabriel Winant, has written about work inequality and capitalism in modern America. His writing has appeared in The Nation, The New Republic, Dissent, and N+1. And he's the author of a new book, The Next Shift, The Fall of Industry and Rise of Healthcare in Rust Belt America. Gabriel, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So in an opinion piece in The New York Times just recently on March 17th, you called the care economy inhumane. What are the characteristics of the system that made you use such strong language to describe it?
Well, I think, first of all, we can look from the vantage point of the last year and start to unpack some of the experiences that we've had of the pandemic, you know, from the perspective of patients and from the perspective of healthcare workers. And I think it's really important to hold on to both of those perspectives at the same time. From the perspective of patients, obviously, you know, many of our most vulnerable, and in many cases are the poorest members of our society, have also been the most at risk, both in terms of their pre-existing kind of potential comorbidities and risks of COVID-19, which have to do with race and with class. And the worst of that has appeared in nursing homes, right, where the death rate for people who, you know, whose whole lives are inside the healthcare system in a certain way, obviously was horrific. Now, that's to understand that, we have to look at it alongside the workplace situation of, you know, for example, the nursing assistants who take care of people in those same nursing homes. So that's an industry that's grown enormously over the last several decades, particularly beginning around the early 1980s. It's a low-wage industry. Certified nursing assistants who make up the bulk of the workforce in a given long-term care institution very often make $10, $11, $12 an hour. They're overwhelmingly women, often women of color, either immigrants or African-American. And they too became, you know, victims of COVID-19 at very high rates this year. I believe they reached the top of all occupations for workplace mortality rates. Usually the top occupations are like lumberjacks and, you know, roofers and things like that. But I believe in the past year, nursing assistants had the highest workplace mortality rates. And, you know, their working conditions, which have a long history of being quite cruel, and we can talk more about that, were themselves closely tied to the spread of the virus. You know, it's because of the low wages and the precariousness of the work in various other ways, it's common for nursing assistants to have more than one job, often at two different nursing homes, or they might work as a home health aide on the side or something like that. And so they became the unintending vectors in some cases of the virus, and were faced with horrible choices about having to give up their income, you know, by maybe leaving one of their jobs or something like that. And I think this captures a lot, in an intensified way, a lot of the general dynamics of this growing area of our economy, the ways that it depends on both, in many cases, exploiting and dehumanizing patients, treating them as revenue centers rather than people in need of care, And at the same time, carrying out that exploitation of patients by also exploiting low wage and insecure workers.
And there's so many things I want to follow up on there. So you mentioned that many of these nursing assistants have to go from one job to another. They can't make ends meet on just one job. They might work in a home or hospital and a nursing home. And they often are traveling on public transportation, right? Which also plays into that. And also their living conditions are often in, you know, overcrowded situations. So it's those, social determinants that also play into their, put them at greater risk for a virus like COVID. But do you think that that the fact that they became these unintended vectors and had such high workplace mortality, and at the same time were being called healthcare heroes, right? But not being compensated for that. Do you think that the virus sort of is helping to shine a light on that problem right now? Or do you think we're just going to go back to forgetting about the whole thing?
It's a good question. I mean, certainly there's a sort of bitter irony. And I think if you talk to healthcare workers, they'll tell you that they now hate the phrase essential worker. That's generally been my experience, is that they hear that as a kind of poison, because it's been unaccompanied by any kind of seriousness, right? You can't call someone essential and then treat them as though they're disposable, which is what we've done, without really, you know, angering people. So I think it's a political question that we're going to have to wait and see. You know, will there be more, you know, collective action by healthcare workers in the future? And I think, you know, my bet is that there will be, but I don't know that for sure. I hope that there will be.
And, you know, we said that these are often women and often minorities. So what are some of the historical forces that have drawn women and people of color to these types of jobs? And how does that diminish their ability to, you know, leverage themselves in terms of their wages and their benefits?
Yeah, so this is a story that my book tells. The healthcare industry as a whole was constructed as a kind of external adjunct to manufacturing. And I can tell you more about what that means, but for the purposes of the question you just asked, what it means is that the labor markets in healthcare were always segmented off and were always secondary labor markets. And in fact, they were often unregulated. So from 1947 until 1974, a period of almost 30 years, during which time much of the modern healthcare system was built, healthcare workers were not covered by labor law. They had no legal protections in terms of the right to form a union. They weren't covered by employment law, which is things like wages and hours regulations, until the late 1960s. And in general, what that meant was that the people who were the most, had the least power in the labor market, who were the most vulnerable in employment relationships, were likeliest to wind up doing that kind of work. It drew, obviously, on much older histories, the idea of, you know, women are kind of naturally altruistic and they're kind of naturally fitted in some way for nursing, right? These are kind of old stereotypes that go back a long, long time. But they get updated with every generation and with new institutions. And so those kind of older stereotypes flowed into this kind of institutionalization of different tiers of employment that was brought about by the New Deal state and, you know, in the 1930s and 1940s, and the kind of regulation of labor markets that it had to do with. Then, so, you know, first you have the kind of construction of healthcare as this, like I say, this sort of secondary and adjunct type tier toward the core of working class employment, which is in manufacturing, which was regulated, which was secure. But when manufacturing went away, and this again is something we can talk more about, households that had depended on an industrial wage to keep them afloat in a kind of configuration of an industrial breadwinner and a housewife and their kids, that wasn't working anymore for a lot of people by the 1970s and 1980s. Factory jobs were going away, and that pushed working class women into the workforce at very high rates. So the period of expansion of women's labor force participation basically runs between 1970 and 2000. It's contemporaneous with the steep decline of industrial work. And, you know, there's a lot of different things that it meant for women to go into the workplace, right? It could be liberating. It could mean overwork. It could mean all kinds of different things. But what I can say with regard to your question is, you know, if it's 1982 and your steelworker husband got laid off and you have a sense that he's probably not going to get called back anytime soon, and you think to yourself, well, I haven't had a job since I was a teenager. What could I do? A lot of women, the obvious answer was try to become a nurse or become a nursing assistant. Right. And that itself was a racialized question. White women were likelier to have the resources to maybe be able to go to community college or maybe even get a four-year degree and become an RN. African-American women or Latino women were much likelier to have to start at the kind of bottom of the healthcare hierarchy. But one way or another, there was the one industry that was hiring when everything else was shutting down.
And what was interesting to me is when you talked about particularly Pittsburgh, it was that when these factory jobs and manufacturing jobs started going away, the younger, able-bodied, skilled workers that were losing their jobs simply left, right? They could leave and go seek opportunities elsewhere. And the people who were left behind were frailer, older, sicker, more likely to need healthcare services. So that kind of fueled the growth of that.
Yeah. So the process that we call deindustrialization, the decline of industrial employment, it changes the population in really, you know, quite profound ways. So as you say, it leaves behind an older population as young people, particularly young men, for whom it might once have been obvious that, you know, you graduate high school, you go down to the steel mill and you sign your union card and you you get hired. And that was how it worked in 1950. In 1980, that wasn't how it worked anymore. And so they were much likelier to leave. And that happened at the same time as this big cohort. And this is true in industrial cities across the country. This big cohort of workers who had gotten jobs at the peak of industrial employment in the 40s and 50s started to retire. In the 40s and 50s, we fought two giant wars. And that channeled a ton of investment into things like steel and auto and aircraft and all of these industries, electrical. And they reached the peak of their size in terms of employment that they would never achieve again. Every successive cohort was going to be smaller. And so that cohort as a group starts to reach retirement by the time that the plants are shutting down and the young people are leaving. And so you have this really steep aging of the population in industrial cities. My book is about Pittsburgh, and Pittsburgh by 1990 was the second oldest major metropolitan, or Allegheny County, where Pittsburgh sits, was the second oldest mm-hmm. urbanized county in the country after Broward in Florida by 1990. Mm-hmm. But the population also, as it gets older, it gets sicker. And this is partly just because, you know, as an actuarial matter, older populations are sicker populations. But it's also true that poorer populations are sicker populations. And the loss of the main livelihood of the community that steel had meant in a place like Pittsburgh had really severe health effects. And, you know, if you talk to people who lived through that, I mean, they'll tell you, oh yeah, you know, my four neighbors on my same block all had heart attacks that year in 1983. I mean, stories like this are very common. And they're borne out, I think, pretty well by the research. There's a study from 2009 by a couple of economists that shows that, they looked at unemployment claims from Pennsylvania between 1980 and 1986, which was like really rock bottom for manufacturing. And what they found was that people who filed for unemployment in that window of time, who had been high seniority industrial workers, their mortality hazard went up 50 to 100%.
Yeah.
In the immediate aftermath. Now, gradually it leveled off. So if you survived that moment, your mortality hazard stayed elevated above the norm, but it would gradually progress toward the norm, such that over the course of a lifetime, it would be 10 or 15% above the norm. But that tells you something about what kind of health trauma an event like, you know, a mass unemployment shock can be. And so what that means is the population got older, it got sicker, it got poorer, and these things together obviously affect the shape of the healthcare system.
Yeah, drive the need for more services, and hospitals then start to mushroom up and get bigger and need more staff. And so they're pulling in all of these workers. And as these workers are joining the healthcare industry, right, and they're in marginalized, kind of low-paying jobs, does that also contribute to that cycle of poverty and need? Because they're more likely perhaps themselves to become ill, as we saw with the pandemic, less likely to have resources to afford, you know, care, or more likely to rely on Medicaid. So does that also play into that cycle, or is that kind of a separate?
Yeah, well, I think this is why in some way, the same trends kind of continue today, even though, I mean, steel is long gone, right? We don't really have the same dynamic of industrial job loss forcibly transitioning and shocking people out of the way that they had been surviving into a new way. But something about what happened in the 80s is clearly still with us now. I'd like to point out to people that, you know, the statistic I'm sure all your listeners know that we always talk about in health policy in this country, how incredibly high our spending per capita is. And the moment when that really started to diverge from, you know, other wealthy industrialized countries was the early 1980s. That's if you graph it over time and in comparison to other countries, that's when the U.S. starts to depart from that. There's a lot of things that cause that. I don't want to claim that the story I'm telling is the only thing that contributes to that. But I do think one way we can understand that is that increasing social inequality since the late 70s, which has been a pretty steady increase, it generates social problems, it generates social dislocation, it creates a kind of a mess socially, right? And we haven't really solved that mess in a fundamental way, but that mess presents through all different kinds of symptoms that different institutions then may try to step up and manage in one form or another. And we may not like that, how that looks, right? I mean, I think a really good example of this is the extreme growth of the prison system, right? Which I certainly think is a crime against humanity, basically. But, you know, that's an example of a social institution that has figured out how to partly manage the social inequality problem, right? By saying, we could just lock people up, right? And there are politicians mm-hmm. who kind of then advocate that for that. And there are communities that, you know, see that as a stream of revenue that will generate employment and so on. And
right.
there's a whole process there.
It's a whole industry, yeah.
And, you know, I don't think that's good, but I do think we can understand it that way. Something similar is happening with the healthcare industry. That's one of the key arguments in my book. We basically decided, without ever really knowing we were doing this, that we were going to shunt the problems of social inequality into hospitals and nursing homes and home care and into the healthcare industry as much as we could and hope that the healthcare industry would figure it out for us. And, you know, that in some ways has, again, sort of solved or managed some number of problems. It's created a bunch of new ones. And it's also closely tied to why the healthcare industry has grown so much and sort of eaten so much of our economy up because we're using it to do something.
So one of the things that I heard you talk about that I didn't really know, or if I knew, I forgot, was that President Truman in the 1940s proposed a universal healthcare system paid for by a payroll tax. And in fact, in 1947, he wrote, and I quote, "As a nation, we should not reserve good health and long productive life for the well-to-do only, but should strive to make good health equally available to all citizens." Why couldn't he get it done?
Well, you know, this had been an idea that had been present among social reformers and activists going back to the beginning of the 20th century. Many of the same people who were the kind of intellectual power behind what would become Social Security and other familiar social programs, they thought that healthcare was going to happen through that process too. And they tried to do it in the 19-teens and 20s, and it didn't really work. And they tried to do it in the 1930s when Social Security was passed as part of Social Security, which sort of would have been the obvious way. And it couldn't quite make it happen then. And so coming off of World War II, President Truman thought that this was his opportunity. And this was in a moment when industrial unions, the United Auto Workers, the United Steel Workers, the United Electrical Workers, these giant organizations of industrial workers that had formed over the past 10 or 15 years and become newly very powerful forces on the left of American politics, were clamoring for expanding the welfare state. And they collided with a few different forces that kind of stopped this from happening in the late 40s. The first was, I mean, we have to acknowledge it, the vociferous hostility of the medical establishment. The AMA really went to bat to stop this. And they were really much more powerful then as a kind of collective organization than they would be in later years than they are now. So it's a little hard to imagine from our perspective today. Mm-hmm. Anybody would really listen to the AMA that much, but they were quite powerful. There wasn't really a health insurance lobby the way there is today because health insurance didn't really exist that much. I mean, it existed, but it wasn't part of everyday life the way it is now. But the doctors were powerful. However, this was also the onset of the Cold War. And, you know, McCarthyism was just about to start to happen. It would itself really severely weaken a lot of these left-wing policy makers and organizations like unions. In one case, one of the unions I mentioned, the United Electrical Workers, were decimated basically by McCarthyism. And it would, you know, a lot of the most progressive thinkers would get driven out of the government under, you know, suspicions of being communist sympathizers and this kind of thing. And, you know, it made making a big progressive social program harder to pull off. You know, as the unions began to see that this was maybe not going to work out, they started to kind of hedge their bets. And they started to instead put pressure on their employers for private agreements to cover their own members. So, you know, they still, I mean, to this day, most of these organizations still nominally support a Medicare for All plan, but they kind of stopped fighting for it so hard when they realized, oh, we can get GM or we can get US Steel to, you know, through a strike and a contract settlement to cover our members. And in 1949, the steelworkers secured their first health plan for their members that way. A couple of federal judicial cases in 1949 from the steel industry affirmed that employers, when they engage in collective bargaining, that's one of the mandatory subjects, they have to talk about healthcare. And from then on, healthcare became something that got determined in private sector labor markets. I mean, we now take it for granted as this weird thing that we do in this country, that you get your healthcare through your job. And where that came from was this moment in the late 1940s when unions figured out this kind of compromise that they were going to build a welfare state in the private sector.
Are we kind of unique in that model here?
Yeah. I mean, you know, not every country, not every kind of wealthy welfare state country has something like a Medicare for All system or a national health service like they do in England and Great Britain. But linking employment and healthcare so directly is unique to this country and has led to really strange and perverse outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen how problematic it could be during the pandemic, for sure, when people were losing their jobs at a time when they needed healthcare more than ever. So how does consolidation among the hospital industry and kind of the public-private partnership way of paying for healthcare, how does that all contribute to keeping those wages low for those bottom rung healthcare workers?
That's a great question. So the way I like to describe this is, well, first of all, to kind of move forward quickly from that moment in the 1940s I was just describing, once you had this private sector employment basis for health insurance, it meant that you were going to get providers to service that market. Right, hospitals started to invest and grow, and they stopped being places where the poor went to die, and they instead became places that everyone used for one thing or another in their life. That caused the price of healthcare to rise, and as it did so over the course of the 1950s, people who didn't have access to health insurance through their jobs got priced out of the market. So who would that be, right? It's not the rich, because they're not getting priced out. It's not people who have it through their union. It's the retired, and it's the poor. And so Medicare and Medicaid got passed in 1965 as a way of responding to that problem. That's a more complicated story than how I'm describing here, but that's the basic gist of it. But what Medicare and Medicaid did was not displace private administration of healthcare and not displace private health insurance, but just stand the government in as another buyer, right? It just rounded out the existing system. And these things together, the public provided insurance programs of Medicare and Medicaid, and the publicly regulated but privately provided systems that people like steelworkers and auto workers had, together channeled a ton of revenue into the healthcare industry, and it just ballooned, especially in the 70s. There's a kind of complicated process having to do with Medicare policy that then leads to some consolidation in the 80s and especially 90s in terms of hospitals in particular. But what's important to understand from the perspective of your question is that the whole industry is the creation of public policy. It's not all publicly owned or publicly administered. It's not even all publicly funded, although a lot of it is. 37% of our national health expenditure is Medicare and Medicaid. But it's all in one way or another the product of either direct public funding or subsidy or regulation. And it was created to fulfill this public purpose that for political reasons we couldn't get the government to do. But it's still a kind of public purpose, right? Which is why it's so heavily regulated. What that means is people who work in the healthcare industry are kind of these weird subcontracted public employees. You know, if you work for a nursing home, this is the clearest case, I think. If you work for a nursing home, Medicaid is paying for a lot of, you know, the bill that is your wages. And Medicaid is sort of keeping afloat the institution you work for. But even if you work for a hospital or you work in home healthcare, in a whole bunch of different ways, public policy has created your whole workplace situation. However, when you sign your, if you have a contract or you agree to your employment, when you take your job, you aren't negotiating with Medicaid or Medicare or HHS or even, you know, your state health department. You're negotiating with this private party that has kind of stuck itself in the middle. So I like to compare it to, a lot of subcontracting situations that are pretty familiar in the American workplace today, right? That employers will subcontract parts of the functions that they want to get carried out as a way of offloading some costs and separating workers from profits, mm-hmm. right, in the private sector. And basically, if you take a step back and look at the situation of the healthcare worker, that's what's been done to the healthcare worker. The healthcare worker is doing this social function that politically we've decided we need to do, but we don't want to take responsibility for it socially. And so we've devolved it, offloaded it onto these private actors who then figure out where they can kind of get themselves rich in the process.
Do you see the insurance industry as playing a similar role in a way? Because they are an intermediary between the provider and the patient, also pulling profits out of the system.
Yeah, definitely the insurance industry is an intermediary in a similar way. The insurance industry is generally not directly affecting employment. It's indirectly affecting employment in a sort of similar way to how public policy is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously the main way that public policy affects employment is, in fact, in the guise of insurance. But yeah, we also have this dynamic that I alluded to earlier of a kind of arms race between hospitals and insurers. I mean, I write about Pittsburgh in detail, where this has happened in a really crazy way. In the early 1980s, Medicare, Congress changed how Medicare reimburses hospitals from a retrospective system where basically hospitals would just send a bill. You know, give us 102, here are our costs, give us 102%. And so they kind of had blank checks. And that was part of how people got to use the system to take care of themselves when no one else would. Congress changed that to a prospective system where they fixed a price basically to every possible diagnosis. That caused hospitals to begin to consolidate. And as hospitals began to consolidate, they got into a struggle, a market power struggle with insurers. In Pittsburgh, what this led to was the formation of the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, which is this massive healthcare giant hospital chain, on the one hand, and the merger of Blue Cross and Blue Shield into Highmark, on the other hand. And, you know, as each was trying to get market leverage on the other. And, you know, eventually UPMC launched its own insurance company to compete with Highmark in its market. Highmark bought up a bunch of hospitals to compete with UPMC in its market. Each of them tried to, you know, not let people covered by the other insurer come to their hospitals or covered by their insurance go to the other's hospitals. And so you have this really crazy, I mean, this is part of how we can understand how it's dehumanizing to patients, right?
Yeah.
Profitability pressures on either on the insurance side or on the hospital side lead to this really intense competition over the healthcare dollar that gets passed on both to the worker and to the patient.
I want to talk a little bit about the Biden administration and the $2 trillion investment in infrastructure and jobs that they're proposing. How do you think that those dollars should be reallocated to maybe take into account the needs of healthcare workers as opposed to these manufacturing jobs and blue collar jobs that are probably not coming back, but yet politicians always want to talk about?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's lots of blue collar work that certainly needs to get done. I don't mean to imply otherwise, you know, and in particular, like the need to adapt to, you know, to do some kind of green transition as urgently as we can. I mean, that's, I think, very, very clear. So the point I was trying to make in that op-ed is not, you know, screw that, but rather we have a set of questions about climate change adaptation And then we have a set of questions about our labor market. And to some degree, those are the same question. And to some degree, they're different ones. And if when we're thinking about our labor market, we don't have to pretend that the only good jobs are hard hat jobs, right? We can actually take seriously the way that our economy and our labor market has changed already and, you know, begin to invest in the kinds of work that it does seem like we really have sustainable demand for, and to try to improve that work rather than, you know, offloading this kind of tasks onto poor women and, you know, keeping them poor doing so. I mean, this can look like a lot of different things, I think. You know, I think we'll always need some kind of institutional long-term care, but to the extent that we can make home care a good job, or home and community-based services, better work, most people would rather that their loved ones be in a home or community-based setting rather than a long-term care institution. Mm-hmm. Often the working conditions are actually somewhat better also, not necessarily in terms of wages, but in terms of being able to pay attention to, in terms of staffing and hours and this kind of thing, as a generalization. So, you know, I think increasing the budget for long-term care in general is really, really important, right? We pay for it through Medicaid at the moment, and I think probably we'll continue to do that in the near future, unfortunately. But increasing the budget for home and community-based services and actually setting some, you know, higher wage standards, and for even for those who still work in long-term care institutions, you know, raising wages and in particular increasing staffing levels. All of these are things that the federal government really can do. I mean, even state governments can do a lot of this because, again, they're the ones paying for it. So I think those are kind of urgent things that really would make a tremendous difference in the lives of millions of workers as well as patients.
So in New York, where I'm based, hospitals in New York State have to be nonprofit organizations. Do you think that that's a good policy to take that private profit margin out of healthcare?
Yeah, I mean, I think for-profit healthcare is almost always a harmful phenomenon. I think there's really good evidence for that, certainly from the pandemic, but even before the pandemic. I think we do have a problem in that there are lots of nonprofits that are, you know, according to their tax status and their accounting, are in some way nonprofit, but in their behavior are not really distinguishable from a for-profit corporation. And I think we have to look harder at a question of ownership. I mean, in the long term, I would be for, you know, a system where private ownership, as we know it today, is eradicated in the healthcare system. I mean, that's a very different situation than what we're in now. But whether that looks like public ownership in the way that, you know, Britain has public ownership of hospitals, whether it looks like some kind of worker and patient trust-based ownership. I mean, I think you can imagine different kinds of experimental models, you know, cooperative models. There's all kinds of things that you could envision. But I think so long as ownership represents a distinct set of interests from patients and from employees, you're going to get conflicts of interest. And those conflicts of interest tend to be harmful to patients and employees.
Mm-hmm. So now here's the really hard question. So we've been talking about healthcare reform in this country since the Clinton administration, maybe even longer than that. And yet nobody seems to be able to accomplish it. Do you think that there's a politically feasible way to achieve true reform in this country?
In the long term, I think it's sort of inevitable, simply because the public-private balance in combination with ever-expanding costs and ever-expanding sort of footprint in our economy, I mean, it generates conflict, it generates social problems constantly. And there's not really, it doesn't really have a rational defense. It's just the weight of history, right? It's just inertia that keeps us doing it in the way that this kind of extremely wasteful and also inhumane way. You know, I think that part of the problem has been, and this is an argument I make in the book, that because the healthcare system has stood in for other kinds of solutions to rising social inequality, all kinds of people have an investment in their little pocket of it, continuing to work the way that it does. And in some cases, that's really not defensible. You know, in some cases, that's insurance companies gouging people, making tons of money and so on. But it also looks like people worrying that they're going to lose an insurance plan that they have had for a while and think works for them. Older people worrying that Medicare is going to get changed for the worse. And I don't think that those worries are right, but I think we can understand them. So I think that cutting through all of that, all this kind of nest of conflicting interests and strange bedfellows and all the weird stuff that makes up healthcare politics in this country, I don't think it's going to succeed without some kind of like extinction of profit making in healthcare, which I think is ultimately what we need. I don't think that's going to work without a real movement from below, both of patients and insurance subscribers, but in particular of healthcare workers. And I think there's a really instructive comparison we can make here with public education, where teachers have been able over the last few years to demand more investment in public education and to lead a kind of social movement and demand for that, because it's a public system that everyone kind of recognizes that they have a part in, and they want to succeed, and they look to teachers and they basically trust them as the people who probably know, what is needed and whose well-being is connected to their own children's well-being and so on. And, healthcare, although it's publicly funded to a large degree, is still heavily privatized. It's different in various other ways. And I think the more the healthcare workers can figure out how to behave like teachers have behaved, the more the healthcare system can be made to look like the education system, which I think is what we want.
It's a very interesting analogy. I'm just trying to imagine what it would be like if our public schools were run like our healthcare system, and we had, private ownership of different schools within a community and different.
And you were allowed to go to this one, but not that one, or it cost way more to go to that. Or, I mean, you can imagine, our higher ed system looks a little bit like that, right? And it's this mess of debt and bad working conditions and so on.
Very interesting. Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to share your thoughts with us today. Tell our listeners, if you don't mind, where they can learn more about you and your book.
Sure. So you can find my book. It's called The Next Shift, at a bookstore near you. I encourage you to buy it from an independent bookstore and not Amazon, or directly from the press, Harvard University Press. If you Google The Next Shift, The Fall of Industry and the Rise of Healthcare, you will find it. And I appreciate your interest.
Excellent. Well, thank you again for joining us, Gabriel Winant.
Thank you.
New Healthcare Confidential episodes are available on heliumradio.com on Mondays at 10 a.m. on the Care One Network and at 2 p.m. on the Life Improvement Radio Network. You can listen on demand wherever you access podcasts. Our show is produced by Life Improvement Media with thanks to Eric Remmel and Justin Ulrich. Our theme song is an original composition written and performed by Patrick Pekarsik. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave us your feedback and help us continue the conversation on the Healthcare Confidential Facebook page. Be well, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Helium Radio. The views expressed by show hosts or their guests are their own and should not be construed in any way as advice from Helium Radio. We make no recommendations or endorsements for radio show programs, services, or products mentioned on air or on our website. Personal perspectives expressed by producers, writers, and editors will always be presented as such. Any rebroadcast or retransmission without the express written consent of Helium Radio is strictly prohibited. Thanks for listening.